He pressed the starter and drove on, while she sat stiffly straight, asking no questions. A stretch of violent turquoise blue split the cliffs ahead, ending the road. It took her a second to realize that it was a lake. The motionless water seemed to condense the blue of the sky and the green of the pine-covered mountains into so brilliantly pure a color that it made the sky look a dimmed, pale gray. A streak of boiling foam came from among the pines and went crashing down the rocky steps to vanish in the placid water. A small granite structure stood by the stream. Galt stopped the car just as a husky man in overalls stepped out to the threshold of the open doorway. It was Dick McNamara, who had once been her best contractor.
"Good day, Miss Taggart," he said happily. "I'm glad to see that you weren't hurt badly."
She inclined her head in silent greeting. It was like a greeting to the loss and the pain of the past, to a desolate evening, and the desperate face of Eddie Willers telling her the news of this man's disappearance. Hurt badly, she thought? I was, but not in the plane crash. On that evening, in an empty office. Aloud, she asked, "What are you doing here? What was it that you betrayed me for, at the worst time possible?" He smiled, pointing at the stone structure and down at the rocky drop where the tube of a water main went vanishing into the underbrush.
"I'm the utilities man," he said. "I take care of the water lines, the power lines, and the telephone service."
"Alone?"
"Used to. But we've grown so much in the past year that I've had to hire three men to help me."
"What men? From where?"
"Well, one of them is a professor of economics who couldn't get a job outside because he taught that you can't consume more than you've produced. One is a professor of history who couldn't get a job because he taught that the inhabitants of slums were not the men who made this country. And one is a professor of psychology who couldn't get a job because he taught that men are capable of thinking."
"They work for you as plumbers and linesmen?"
"You'd be surprised how good they are at it."
"And to whom have they abandoned our colleges?"
"To those who were wanted there." He chuckled. "How long ago was it that I betrayed you, Miss Taggart? Not quite 3 years, wasn't it? It's the John Galt line that I refused to build for you. Where's your line now?" "But my lines have grown in that time from the couple of miles that Mulligan had built when I took over to hundreds of miles of pipe and wire all within the space of this valley."
He saw the swift, involuntary look of eagerness on her face, the look of a competent person's appreciation. He smiled, glanced at her companion, and said softly,
"You know, Miss Taggart, when it comes to the John Galt line, maybe it's I who followed it, and you who are betraying it."
She glanced at Galt. He was watching her face, but she could read nothing in his. As they drove on along the edge of the lake, she asked, "You've mapped this route deliberately, haven't you? You're showing me all the men whom..." She stopped, feeling inexplicably reluctant to say it, and said instead, "Whom I have lost."
"I'm showing you all the men whom I have taken away from you," he answered firmly. This was the root, she thought, of the guiltlessness of his face.
He had guessed and named the words she had wanted to spare him. He had rejected a goodwill that was not based on his values. And in proud certainty of being right, he had made a boast of that which she had intended as an accusation. Ahead of them, she saw a wooden pier projecting into the water of the lake. A young woman lay stretched on the sun-flooded planks, watching a battery of fishing rods. She glanced up at the sound of the car, then leaped to her feet in a single swift movement, a shade too swift, and ran to the road. She wore slacks rolled above the knees of her bare legs. She had dark, disheveled hair and large eyes. Galt waved to her.
"Hello, John. When did you get in?" she called.
"This morning," he answered, smiling and driving on.
Dagny jerked her head to look back and saw the glance with which the young woman stood looking after Galt. And even though hopelessness, serenely accepted, was part of the worship in that glance, she experienced a feeling she had never known before, a stab of jealousy.
"Who is that?" she asked.
"Our best fishwife. She provides the fish for Hammond's grocery market."
"What else is she?"
"You've noticed that there's a what else for every one of us here?"
"She's a writer,
the kind of writer who wouldn't be published outside. She believes that when one deals with words, one deals with the mind." The car turned into a narrow path, climbing steeply into a wilderness of brush and pine trees. She knew what to expect when she saw a handmade sign nailed to a tree with an arrow pointing the way. The Buena Esperanza Pass. It was not a pass. It was a wall of laminated rock with a complex chain of pipes, pumps, and valves climbing like a vine up its narrow ledges. But it bore on its crest a huge wooden sign, and the proud violence of the letters announcing their message to an impassable tangle of ferns and pine branches was more characteristic, more familiar than the words. Wyatt Oil. It was oil that ran in a glittering curve from the mouth of a pipe into a tank at the foot of the wall, as the only confession of the tremendous secret struggle inside the stone, as the unobtrusive purpose of all the intricate machinery. But the machinery did not resemble the installations of an oil derrick, and she knew that she was looking at the unborn secret of the Buena Esperanza Pass. She knew that this was oil drawn out of shale by some method men had considered impossible. Ellis Wyatt stood on a ridge watching the glass dial of a gauge embedded in the rock. He saw the car stopping below and called, "Hi, Dagny. Be with you in a minute." There were two other men working with him, a big muscular roughneck at a pump halfway up the wall, and a young boy by the tank on the ground. The young boy had blonde hair and a face with an unusual purity of form. She felt certain that she knew this face, but she could not recall where she had seen it. The boy caught her puzzled glance, grinned, and, as if to help her, whistled softly, almost inaudibly, the first notes of Halley's Fifth Concerto. It was the young brakeman of the Comet. She laughed. "It was the Fifth Concerto by Richard Halley, wasn't it?" "Sure," he answered. "But do you think I'd tell that to a scab?"
"A what?"
"What am I paying you for?" asked Ellis Wyatt, approaching. The boy chuckled, darting back to seize the lever he had abandoned for a moment. "It's Miss Taggart who couldn't fire you if you loafed on the job."
"I can."
"That's one of the reasons why I quit the railroad, Miss Taggart," said the boy. "Did you know that I stole him from you?" said Wyatt. "He used to be your best brakeman, and now he's my best grease monkey. But neither one of us is going to hold him permanently."
"Who is?"
"Richard Halley. Music. He's Halley's best pupil." She smiled. "I know. This is a place where one employs nothing but aristocrats for the lousiest kinds of jobs." "They're all aristocrats, that's true," said Wyatt, "because they know that there's no such thing as a lousy job, only lousy men who don't care to do it." The roughneck was watching them from above, listening with curiosity. She glanced up at him. He looked like a truck driver, so she asked, "What were you outside? A professor of comparative philology, I suppose?"
"No, ma'am," he answered. "I was a truck driver." He added, "But that's not what I wanted to remain."
Ellis Wyatt was looking at the place around them with a kind of youthful pride, eager for acknowledgement. It was the pride of a host at a formal reception in a drawing room, and the eagerness of an artist at the opening of his show in a gallery. She smiled and asked, pointing at the machinery, "Shale oil?"
"Uh-huh."
"That's the process which you were working to develop while you were on Earth?" She said it involuntarily, and she gasped a little at her own words. He laughed.
"While I was in hell, yes. I'm on Earth now."
"How much do you produce?"
200 barrels a day."
A note of sadness came back into her voice. "It's the process by which you once intended to fill 5 tank trains a day."
"Dagny," he said earnestly, pointing at his tank, "one gallon of it is worth more than a trainful back there in hell, because this is mine, all of it, every single drop of it, to be spent on nothing but myself."
He raised his smudged hand, displaying the greasy stains as a treasure, and a black drop on the tip of his finger flashed like a gem in the sun.
"Mine," he said. "Have you let them beat you into forgetting what that word means, what it feels like? You should give yourself a chance to relearn it."
"You're hidden in a hole in the wilderness," she said bleakly, "and you're producing 200 barrels of oil, when you could have flooded the world with it."
"What for? To feed the looters?"
"No, to earn the fortune you deserve. But I'm richer now than I was in the world. What's wealth but the means of expanding one's life? There's two ways one can do it, either by producing more or by producing it faster.
and that's what I'm doing. I'm manufacturing time.
What do you mean?
I'm producing everything I need. I'm working to improve my methods, and every hour I save is an hour added to my life. It used to take me 5 hours to fill that tank. It now takes three. The two I saved are mine. As pricelessly mine as if I move my grave 2 hours further away for every five I've got. It's 2 hours released from one task to be invested in another. 2 more hours in which to work, to grow, to move forward.